Welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling this meeting of the Taxes Committee to order. We do have a quorum present. The first item on the agenda is if I could get a motion to move the minutes for February 12th, 2024.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from the February 12th meeting of the Taxes Committee.
Representative Norris moves the minutes. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So welcome back to Tax Committee. We had sort of a special early Monday hearing, but this is sort of our first like regular normal hearing. So just, you know, this year, I think we're, since it is a policy year, not a budget year, we're going to have probably like a slimmed down agenda of things that we're going to work on. But there certainly are a lot of tax policy items that can use our attention. And so I'm looking forward to using our time to do that. And, you know, just appreciate all the members of the committee for the good and respectful conversations that we all have. And so I'm anticipating that we're going to be able to do a lot more of that this session. So we do have a couple of new staff members joining us, and so I just want to give each of them an opportunity to quickly introduce themselves. First of all, we want to, you know, I just am so appreciative of Kathy Schill's service to our committee and to the legislature and to the people of Minnesota, and we wish her the best in her retirement and hope she's enjoying it and are thrilled to welcome a new member of our fiscal staff, the new fiscal analyst, Katrina Highmark. Ms. Highmark, would you just want to say hi to the committee quick and tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. Hello, everyone. Great to be here. Thank you very much for the warm welcome, Madam Chair. I'm Katrina Highmark. I have a PhD in political science from the University of Minnesota. And prior to working here at the House, today is my official 14th day being here at the House of Representatives. I was a professor at the Humphrey School of Public Policy, as well as University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and River Falls. So thank you all. It's wonderful to meet you and to be here.
Wonderful. Welcome, Ms. Highmark. And she's joining our ABLE staff, and so I'm sure members will be reaching out to you with questions. She's especially stepping up on all of the property tax items. That's going to be her kind of focus. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
The new fiscal analyst missed something. She never said anything about being an Aiken gobbler.
Yeah, Ms. Highmark.
I think that's pretty important.
Thank you, Representative Davids.
Anytime.
A gobbler, you say, is that what it is? Aiken gobbler. Okay, we welcome all gobblers and others to the committee today. Aiken another one. It's all gobblers. Welcome. We also are welcoming a new partisan researcher on the GOP side. We also want to just thank Kelly Cavanati for her exceptional service to the GOP and to our committee and to the people of Minnesota. And we're happy to welcome Sam Moyer. You want to just say hi to the committee quick?
Yeah, I'll welcome Kelly, too. she's great. yeah, Sam Moyer. I've been in the House for 9 years, and I'm happy to be here in Taxes. Thanks for having me.
Where'd you graduate?
Yeah, are you a gobbler? Or?
You don't want to stick your neck out if you're a gobbler.
Well, high school, Lake City Tigers, yes.
Okay. Well, I'm a Minneapolis South High Tiger, if you want to get down to it. So me and you, maybe we got it. All right. Wonderful. Thanks for introducing yourselves. So today we're just going to hear some high level overviews. You know, we obviously we had a big tax bill. We had a very busy conference committee, and so this committee didn't like get to review all of the items in the tax bill. We certainly looked at some of them, but obviously that process is necessarily about kind of, you know, comparing the two bills. And so we are pleased to welcome first up our Commissioner Marquardt for a little overview from the Department of Revenue. Please feel free to grab some mochi donuts on your way off of the stage if you'd like. Welcome back, Mr. Commissioner.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Nice to be back here again. And welcome to the new staff, too. We know that the Tax Committee is the best committee in the legislature, so we know that.
Clearly. For the record, the record will reflect that the tax committee is the best committee. Thank you for establishing that.
And I am here, first of all, I'm Paul Marquardt, the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, here with Joanna Bears, who's Legislative Director here at the Department of Revenue. And thank you for the opportunity. What I'd like to do is talk about the implementation and kind of the workings of how we kind of put the 2023 tax bill that went into law, how we actually implement that so it gets out to taxpayers. So and then talk about some of the challenges and talk about some of the things that don't always go just like we would like them to go. I do, before we go further, say I was very much honored to be appointed to this position over a year ago by Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, and I have thoroughly enjoyed the time. I've got a great staff at the Department of Revenue, very hardworking and dedicated staff, and I will say a real source of enjoyment has been able to work with fellow colleagues, being in front of this committee and working through the legislative process. And that has been very, very enjoyable, and thank you for that. The Department of Revenue works for you. You are a tax policy body here in the legislature, and a big function of the Department of Revenue is to work for you, for our taxpayers, and for the state of Minnesota. So I want to be very upfront here. As at the end of this presentation, if there are questions, if there are comments, if there are criticisms on how we as a department can better serve you or anything else, let's talk about that. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm here, and I want to be a department that's transparent and one that is serving the customers that's why we're here for. So I think with that, if we can start with the first slide talking about our mission and our vision, and I want to focus on our work just on this one. If you notice, the department manages and enforces the collection and administration of about $33 billion of annual revenues at a cost of about $200 million a year. I think last year was like $188 million for the department. I think we're around $200 million, maybe a little bit more. But if you look at what would be the administrative cost of that $200 million compared to the $33 billion, it's 0.6%. 0.6% to do all that. Now, I will say I have nothing to do with that at all. But what I'm trying to say here is the Department of Revenue, whether or not it has been under Republican administration or Democratic administration, has always, and I've got experience 22 years on the tax committee watching this department, has always been very efficient in with the amount of work that it's doing, and hopefully we can carry that on. So if we can move to the next one, these are basically kind of our general customers and general routine each and every year. So about 3.1 million individual income tax filers per year. As of last year, about 93% of all filers file electronically, and about 75% go direct deposit. And just for some statistics, at the end of basically kind of the filing season, April 15th last year, the department had completed or processed 91% of the individual returns versus an historical average of about 88%. And on the time that it takes to get a refund out, we went from about 9.5 days, which is historical average, to 9 days. So we shaved like a half a day getting that check out. But, I mean, I think those are important metrics because we want to complete those taxes on time, and we want to get that refund back out to folks, too. So otherwise, there's some numbers there. Of course, we work with a lot of customers, legislators, of course, tax professionals. We are working constantly and having seminars that might focus just on military and what their benefits are, seniors, and so forth. We do a lot of that. Property tax refunds, We work with all the county assessors and, of course, businesses that file and pay taxes and sales taxes. So if we could move to the next one. So this is really a timeline chart of how the process works. And if you notice, it starts in May or whenever session may end, which isn't always that time. And you can also see, and now I realize, when you go into June and not maybe pass things till June or at the end, it does shorten up that time frame. And I now find out the Department of Revenue has to scramble a little bit more than normal. So at any rate, under that first one where it says synthesized law changes, that is where the standard deduction error was caught. So you have attorneys and folks from the department that start going through all the laws, you know, really closely again, because they have to end up drawing up the new forms that are required. And that's where they caught that was in that process. And that was, I think, in June that that actually was middle of June that that was caught or somewhere close to that time. So once they do that, they are then start writing up the new tax forms. And I will say that based on the 2023 tax bill, there were over 300 tax forms and instructions that needed to be changed. Might be maybe only a line on a form, but that many had to be changed. And so they go through that process. They then publish a near final form around in August. And that's when they start really working with our vendors into it, you know, TurboTax, H&R Block and those, and our tax preparers. And I met with our, kind of a preparation for this, I met with our tax operation team the other day. And they said during this process, they will conduct about 60,000 tests out of this. As they'll test with our vendors and they'll get information back. Is this working and reading? They'll put numbers in and making sure everything works. And, you know, one thing is that like an error default they'll put into the system. We've got something called GenTax. That's our integrated tax system that kind of takes everything. But let's say the maximum credit, excuse me, is like $200. Then someone put $2,000 in, it would kick that out. So they, you know, program it so it does those type of things. And that would probably kick it into a what we'd call an early audit. And that's not a full-blown audit. It just means, okay, someone gave some misinformation, it doesn't add up, and so what we'd probably do is just send a letter out to the taxpayer and say, can you clarify this or whatever. So that's what we mean by, but it kicks out. So that's why we really want these forms to be as complete and understandable and simple as possible, because the more that kick out is more time-consuming, delays, refunds, and all those type of things, the more you have. So we do that. So that's kind of, and then ultimately there's a final form, and then the final filing season. I will say that a lot of time you have kind of a soft opening where this year it was January 29th is when IRS and Minnesota officially opened, but people start filing early and will start processing some. We found a few glitches already in that week this year that we had time with our providers to go back. And so even with all that testing and that, there's still, especially when you have a pretty complex bill that occurred. So even at kind of towards the end, we were still making a few adjustments that needed to be changed. I think that's good for that one. So this is just a tax bill overview. It does not include everything, and I'll include a few things that aren't there. This is kind of including things that really required a lot of additional work, let's put it that way, outside of the normal. So, of course, it was the extra tax forms, the nation-leading child tax credit, which I'll talk about more detailed later, the one-time rebate, which we'll talk about later, the renter's credit is going from a refund onto the M1 income tax statement. We've got a new cannabis tax, as I was saying, which we will be collecting. I never thought when I was growing up that I would be in charge of collecting $100 million of cannabis money. Just nothing that I would really thought I would be doing, but here we are. Then there's a new tribal nation aid of $35 million a year, a new affordable housing aid. One thing I was proud of is that there was a one-time increase on the homestead credit, state refund, and the renter's credit. That was 20.6%. So whatever you got, we upped it 20.6%. So a lot of people file their property tax refunds when they file their income taxes. And so what we did is we just automatically calculated that. And so if you're going to get $500 on a refund, you ended up getting $600 and something. We just automatically did that. They didn't have to come back and file again. Then, of course, the local government aid and so forth. So this isn't everything. There's the Social Security changes. There's, of course, the revenue raisers, the standard deduction, and the NOLs, which were talked about the other day. But there's also the GILTI. There was the net investment income increase and the dividend received deduction changes. So those aren't there, but those would have also required changes in the tax forms. So I think we can move on. So I want to talk about a couple of the things in a little more detail. So a major goal for Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan was a child tax credit. And that was a proposal. And then the House and Senate went to work on that. And I will tell you the excellent work that was done here in the House on being able to look at combining the working family credit with the child tax credit and using a program that Chair Rest had initiated back on working family credit. And then the House and the tax committee here making it so effective. It ultimately is going to reduce child poverty by 33%, and the work that was done in the House helped make that happen. So it was great teamwork last year with the governor, lieutenant governor, and the House and Senate in really putting together a nation-leading child tax credit. $1,750 per child, 17 and under, no limit on the children. It's refundable permanent. There's the income levels, but it really, it's a little bit deceiving that $35,000. That's to get the maximum. But kind of a rule of thumb is for every child you have, add about $15,000, and that's where it completely phases out. So if you've got one child, married joint filing, at 35, it's probably $50,000 before it completely phases out. With two children, it's 65, 380, four would be 95, five kids would be 110. I mean, so you can, a lot of folks can be getting a credit that might not think they're getting a credit. I don't think I went far enough for some of you. Is that six or seven or eight?
Mr. Commissioner, we're all looking at Representative Weiner because he's amply blessed with children. And so, you know, we're all kind of like, all right, man, you're probably doing okay.
Yeah, I'm sure we had a conversation, I think, about that one day. That was great.
That's what I'm saying.
So ultimately, it's looking to benefit. So, I mean, it covers quite a gamut of income. And so the estimate is about 300,000 families will benefit and a little over 500,000 children. And the Columbia University says it should cut child poverty by about 33%. But the big challenge to get to that 33% is we got to get to those 300,000. And you have to file taxes to get the credit, and the estimate is there's probably at least 10% of that 300,000 that have never filed in the past. So we have to do some really extensive outreach to get to those folks, and that leads us to the next slide. So there has been a very concerted, directed, targeted outreach with a lot of great help from the governor's office and other state agencies, you know, working with the Department of Health, working with the Department of Human Services, who already come in contact with families and children. We're plugging in. We've got a toolkit. We're getting that information out. We have over 170 free tax preparation sites. And last week, the governor, lieutenant governor, it was kind of child tax credit outreach week. They were out visiting these sites and promoting that. And thank you to the tax committee and legislature for dollars for those VITA sites. And another thing that you funded last year was to allow for some grantees, groups, to go out and just promote these credits, child tax credit. Representative Norris, I didn't allude to it, but the K-12 education credit was another one, the working family credit, and so forth. And then also working very much individual outreach and efforts to tribal nations in working through service providers there. And so I have an update. It's really gone quickly. I've got an update on these numbers. As of 7:30 this morning, you can pencil this in, the total amount of claimed child tax credits are now up to $169 million. That is 132,000 children are qualifying with an average credit of $1,359. So it's off. We do know that early on you're going to get a lot of those who are going to get a refund that file early. So you can't extrapolate this and say, well, we're this percent through the filing season. So I mean, this outreach effort needs to continue. And so my ask, too, as legislators, whatever you can do to promote this would really be greatly appreciated. This could be a real game changer for a lot of families. And these dollars, I say $169 million, those are dollars that go right out into the to our communities and back into our neighborhoods. So that's where we're at with that right now. And like I said, any help or advice on avenues or groups that we think we could reach out to, that would be great to hear. If we could move on to the one-time rebate. So there is ended up 2.1 million rebates were sent out. 1.1 million, a little over half, were direct deposit. And those went out literally like in 3 days, really quick. And then the rest, about another million, tended to be checks, which went out. U.S. Bank did that, and it was probably 30 to 50,000 checks a day. So we wound up really getting everything out that first round in about a month. And it probably would have been even quicker. Well, I know it would have been, because we ended up sending out a lot more checks than we had anticipated. And the reason why is because a lot of taxpayers have their refunds or their checking account go through like TurboTax or whatever, and then to them. And we could not send a direct deposit because they were like the second in line. We couldn't do that. So folks that normally should have got a direct deposit, and you probably understand this a lot better than I do, but those who then normally would have got a direct deposit, we couldn't do it because we would have been violating some banking regulations and so forth. So we didn't dare to do that. So we ended up sending checks out to those folks. And that probably went from, instead of maybe 300,000, you now had about a million checks that ended up going out. So what happened is of all the checks that went out, if they weren't cashed within 60 days, they became void. And so that happened in roughly October, November. So those who had not cashed a check, we sent a second round of checks. And if those were not cashed in 60 days, we voided those. And that was February 6th, was kind of that second round of the 60 days. We still have about 128,000 checks to the tune of about $48 million that has not been cashed. So the third round will be, and I'm going to get to this in a second, will not come from submittable. This will be a normal check. I shouldn't say normal, but what you normally see from the Department of Revenue. That will now come. And now if this one is not cashed within 2 years, it will go to unclaimed properties. But that's where we're sitting right there. So I was asked a lot kind of about why a third party submittable. So if you remember in the legislation, there's about $20 million authorized for a third party vendor, which was submittable. And the reason submittable, first of all, was used was they had worked for a number of years with U.S. Bank. And they were also the ones that worked when we did the frontline worker pay rebates back in 2022. They have a good track record of performance and security. And the reason why we looked to a third party is these checks went out in August, September, and, well, even more because of – it's the same time, not only as you looked at the chart, we're processing our forms and that, but it's also the same time that we're doing our property tax rebates, which go out the end of August into September. So that's why we went with Submittable. Now, we also had calls that with Submittable, you had a Montana return address. That was, and so some people threw that check away. And in hindsight, if we're to do this again, I would at least have them find a P.O. box in Minnesota to have that address, because it did confuse people. And like I said, now, when the frontline worker pay was done, there was like debit cards, and that return address was actually Indianapolis, because I think it went through U.S. West. And the Department of Revenue didn't really receive it. Of course, not as many went out, and so it wasn't caught last year. But that is certainly something that we would change moving forward. So in the end, about 88% of the checks were cashed. So that 128,000 represents about 6% of all rebates that so far have not been cashed. So I want to go to the last part here. I want to get to this here before I go on. The fourth bullet down is ensuring the right amount gets to the right person. A huge priority for Governor Walz, the administration, and the Department of Revenue was making sure we got the right check to the right person on the right amount. And we have not had any word or calls of someone who received a check that did not. Also, we put these in a discrete envelope, which also caused some problems for people who might have thrown them away. But the reason you do that is so that you don't get theft out of mailboxes. And we did not have a single report of thefts from mailboxes. I checked with call centers and that to see. So when you look at kind of the security, and I'm going to go over a few things that didn't go great, like the taxability and so forth. But when you look at how that went out, you know, as far as getting the right amount to the right person and making sure that you've got the integrity in the system, so far, so good. And so I think, you never know, but right now we think everything has really, really gone well in that regard. So I want to go to the last part, which is a real source of frustration, and that is that the IRS has determined that these one-time rebates are taxable. And because of that, the Department of Revenue has sent out 1099 miscellaneous forms to everyone. Even if you hadn't cashed a check, you still got a 1099 form. So anyone who was ever on the list got a 1099 form, which you have to now include with the instructions on this form of where you have to include this on your federal returns, but also where you can subtract that income amount off of your state return, because of course it's not taxable there. But, and I'll certainly open up to any questions, but I kind of want to cover a little bit of the timeline, which I think is important because there are a few misperceptions on kind of what was involved there. So how did we design the rebate? So we certainly designed it trying to make it non-federally taxable. And back in, from 97 through 2001, those 5 years, there were five rebates. Two of them were property tax rebates, and then the last three, 99, 2000, 2001, were sales tax rebates. The main reason for this rebate was to ease the pain of inflation and to address the burdens people suffered from the pandemic. And we know the pandemic treated people differently. We know, especially in the hospitality industry, those people who had to couldn't work from home suffered the most. And you look at that. So the idea was, let's try to provide dollars that's kind of in relation to how you were impacted by COVID-19. So the sales tax approach probably would not have been taxable. But what the sales tax approach does is you have to go off tax incident and kind of decide how that is, how much everyone would pay. I look back at a 2000 report where they were looking at how much, and if you were like in the $30,000 range on income, you would have gotten on that rebate plan about $300 on sales tax. Where if you're making about $140,000, it was like $1,000. And so the idea was to make it all equal because we thought that came the closest to really representing the burdens that folks had on COVID-19. So that's one reason that approach was not. It was designed to apply to tax year 2021 because that was still in the heart of COVID-19. So it was just based off 21 returns. And then we tried to copy what other states had done that were deemed not taxable. It was refundable tax credit and went from then. So IRS sent out some guidance in February 2023, which at that time allowed those states who had done the rebates in 22, basically all but a couple, allowed them all to say, we're not going to tax it. So when the bill got signed last year on May 24th, the very next day on May 25th, I sent a letter out to IRS asking for their determination on our rebate plan. We didn't get anything back, so we sent something out again in September with another letter. And then finally got a meeting set up in November where the IRS gave us a preliminary opinion that it would be taxable. And at that meeting, they kind of inferred that possibly, so the bill was passed May 24th, and the federal declaration ended May 11th. And they kind of alluded to it. They say that maybe, because we asked them, you know, if we had passed this before May 11th, well, it could have been part of the determination. So that was preliminary. And so after that, we did more work on that. And so one thing is that Section 139 of the Internal Revenue Code says that disaster payment exclusion just has to be in connection with, not during the period of it, but in connection with the disaster. I mean, for example, if you had a flood, which occurred over maybe, you know, a week or two, you know, money comes a lot later after that when people do things and make tax, you know, that might exempt homeowners of that. So it makes sense. And so what we did after that is the governor and I met with Danny Werfel in late December, the IRS commissioner, and talked things through. And what came out of that meeting is that Minnesota just does not have any proof that this legislation was linked to the pandemic. And he did say, nope, he said the May 24th does not matter. He said, you're exactly right. It's in connection with, not during the time frame. So there was some talk that the time made a difference. It did not. So what he told us is, come back, show me a connection between your rebate and the pandemic, because there is nowhere in the legislation, in the language, that says pandemic. Basically, there's no purpose statement. So at that point, the governor put together a letter with the help of the Department of Revenue and including a letter from Chair Gomez and Chair Rest talking about how the intent was related. In that letter, we had five clippings from the five times I appeared before either the Senate Tax Committee or the House Tax Committee or Conference Committee. And in that letter, we put the time of where you could see the statement where I was talking about this is related to easing the pain of inflation. And then in that also, we sent two excerpts from press conferences where we talked about the pandemic, the governor and I and so forth. So we sent that and with other supporting documents and then met with the commissioner again. And at that meeting, He said again and said that the legislative record does not provide the kind of clarity that the purpose of this rebate was to deal with the burdens of the pandemic. And again, basically suggested that in the future, we put actual language in the bill indicating that. So it's disappointing. The IRS has the final determination, and the Department of Revenue, we have a really good working relationship with the IRS. We indicated we all our disappointment with it, and really said that, you know, Minnesota suffered just like every other state in COVID-19, and these other 24 states basically that had tax bills got the benefit we didn't. And I think Arizona isn't going to get that either, the ones that were passed in 23, but basically all the ones that were passed in 22. So what, and I'll open up for questions on this certainly, but you can get a welfare exclusion. They said we didn't qualify under the welfare exclusion to exclude income because our incomes were too high at $150,000 and $75,000, even though California, I think, was $500,000, and they got it. And then didn't qualify for the disaster. And that's the one we were really working hard on because we certainly was in connection with that. So what does that mean for the taxpayer? So, of course, that is a federal increase. And in the incomes up to $150,000 and $75,000 for single, you would fall into either the 10, the 12, or the 22% federal tax brackets. So on the $260 credit, that'd be, you know, $26 on the 10% up to $57.20 on the 22%. With all of that, I don't want members or the public to lose sight of kind of the large picture. So the maximum credit was $1,300. That is married, filing jointly with a maximum of three kids, $1,300. So if you take the $286, which would be the federal tax, that still left, what, $1,014 of net. Remember, only about half the states did a rebate at all. And even at that $1,014, that would still be in the top six or seven as far as the highest maximum rebates in the nation. So now let's not lose sight of that. I mean, is it disappointing? Yes. But it still turned out nationwide to be one of the largest maximum credits that states did provide. I think I have one more slide and then Madam Chair, I'll open up for questions.
Great. That, yeah.
So, Department, looking ahead. So, 2025, the big thing we're looking at and working with advocates right now is a child tax credit advanced periodic payment. So, in the legislation last year that authorized child tax credit, it also authorized the Department of Revenue to set up a periodic advanced payment plan. So we know that what that would be is, I'm not going to compare it to the federal one that they did in 2021, but it's somewhat like it, but hopefully much improved. But what you would get is starting in maybe July, you would start getting an advance payment on your next one with a catch-up at the end when you file. So that would allow families more flexibility, and studies have shown that if you can provide families with that are getting a child tax credit, you can provide them with more flexibility and options. It has a better impact on lowering child poverty and prevents them from falling behind on utility bills, having to go to predatory lenders, and just quality of life type items. So we're working on that. Right now we've been working with advocates, and now we're kind of have, you know, some of the principles, for example, is that families are going to be the decision makers. We're going to, you know, it's, yeah, but, and we've got to make sure it's reliable. We have to make sure we have good information. And when we start this in 2025 for tax year 2024, we want to make sure that it gets to a good start. you know, the integrity in the program is there and that it works. So it may not be everything all at once and may need something later on. One thing we're also looking at is something that would be a safe harbor. One of the things when you look at some of the smaller scale type of advanced payment plans have started, one thing that keeps enrollment really low, and by the way, we're looking at this being an opt-in, so people would have to opt in every year to make sure they have the information and so forth. But we found out that where they thought they didn't know, you know, they might sign up for this advanced payment, then they get an increase in income and they fall off, they got to pay all this money back, and that's it. So we're looking at, first of all, a lot of ways to mitigate that up front. So like a portal that people can go into, because we don't want to create disincentives for people. You know, if a spouse might get a job or you get an increase in income, we don't want that to be a disincentive where people are, geez, you know, trying to figure every dollar out there. So we're going to try to set up a portal. And the fact that 50% of your credit, that's at most, also creates a lot of kind of cushion there too. But possibly also looking at some sort of a safe harbor like the Feds did, where based on income, there'd be some leeway on going over and so forth. But anyway, a lot of that's all in the works as we move forward on that, but we're pretty excited about that. Of course, moving the renter's refund to the renter's credit is that will start next year. E-services, we're always trying to do more and more to meet the customer where they're at, so you can go on a phone, go to a secure portal and do all sorts of information with the Department of Revenue. Don't ask me any more details on that right now, but we're working. And then finally, and I will take any ideas and suggestions, but we're constantly working. It's a major goal at the department, is to make our tax system simpler and more understandable for taxpayers. Because, you know, just talking about these early audits that kind of come through, we don't want those. We want people to understand. We also want people to get, if you're getting a benefit, there's a tax benefit out there, you should get that. You shouldn't have to go through all this and, you know, try to figure out what's what. We need to make the system simpler. Now, we know that, and I'm guilty as a former member of the tax committee, you know, we add things to the tax code every year. So, granted, it gets confusing. But on our end of things, as far as administration, we're always looking at ways in which we can make things simpler. So, it's an honor to be here, and again, whatever we can do, we're here serving you, and I want you to be very frank about how we can better serve you for that. But thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Marquardt, for that presentation. I really appreciate the focus on just on sharing some of the realities of administration with us. I think that, like, I guess, you know, I haven't been in the legislature that long, but as I kind of get deeper into my time here, I realize, like, how important it is to just, like, you know, when we pass great policies, to be sure that we're, like, checking in with the department, making sure that they're being implemented in the way that we intended. And I mean, maybe you guys don't want us to do that, but I want us to do that more. But you know, it's sort of like the back end and the follow through of policymaking, right, is like, how is this actually translating into the impacts that our constituents are feeling and experiencing? And also, really, you know, I think that, like, I'm super frustrated about this IRS determination. I can tell that you are too. I know that the governor and the lieutenant governor worked hard on this. I'm sure you guys are frustrated about this and that your constituents are frustrated about this. And, you know, I think that, like, And Senator Rest, of course, and all of us who think about taxes, and but just appreciate the you laying out kind of, you know, we had every reason to think that we would be able to protect this from federal tax liability, given the aspects of the program design and the way that we communicated about it publicly that you outlined. And so it's a big disappointment, I would say. And I know we have a couple of questions. First up, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I do have a question, but I first want to start out by saying how early in the presentation you talked about how hard the department works at customer service. And I just have to compliment you and agree with that. My constituents, I had several people reaching out to me when the rebates weren't reaching them. I reached out to Ms. Baer, and she's a Wonder Woman, and your staff is amazing. And every single one of my constituent cases was resolved relatively quickly, and they were delighted. And so just from my perspective, you guys have a phenomenal team. You're A-plus on customer service, and I just really want to publicly thank you for how hard you worked on that. So
thank you.
My question, though, is around the cost of the multiple times of sending the checks. Now I guess we're approaching round three, and it'll be out there for 2 years, and then also the cost of sending the 1099s. If you could just, like, there was an initial cost projected for this program, and what is it looking like now with those rough edges? Thank you.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, first of all, thank you for those comments. Really appreciate that. And we won't let that go to Ms. Bear's head. So I think about $22 million total, and correct me if I'm wrong, was appropriated for administration, with like $20 million of it going to Submittable, the group I talked about. And so my understanding is the second and third round of checks are covered in those costs. And I'm not aware of those being outside of those costs. And if it is, I'll come back. But that's never been brought to my attention. I assume that was just part of, assumed in the costs.
Representative Robbins?
I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Oh, there was the other question about the 1099s, right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Commissioner Marquardt.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, yes, there certainly is a cost. I don't know if that was just assumed in the department. I don't think there was anything added again, but I need to check on that. I just don't. Okay. So Ms. Bears informed me that of the $2 million that was in the bill, that's where that came out of, was the 1099s out of that $2 million.
Great. Representative Robbins, you're good? Okay. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the Commissioner, I have a question about, so I opened up the Mankato Free Press this morning. I do it online, but there was an article, front page, talking about the reinterpretation by the department in 2021 for appurtenances and that sort of thing for co-ops. Benco was cited as paying more than $118,000 additional dollars per year because of that reinterpretation in 2021. You know, this is about ratepayer protection in a way, and, you know, I carried a bill. We had a hearing last year talking about this issue. I'm just kind of curious to know, how can we go forward to resolving this issue this year? Because for the ratepayers that live in my district, you know, they're asking me for this protection, $118,000 here, $118,000 there. It adds up. And I'm just kind of curious to know where we can go from here to accomplish what we need to accomplish on this.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you very much. Representative Brand, yes, on that issue, we talked a lot with stakeholders. And last year, that got close to the finish line. And we, the Department of Revenue, as we've worked and we've indicated to all the stakeholders involved, we are in support of that language. And I know they're maybe working on a little different language. And we've got language ready to go. So we're in support. It's just, you know, a matter of the legislative process at this point, Representative.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. And thanks, Representative Brand. And I know you've been working on this issue, and we'll continue to work on it. I know there was sort of pending litigation during consideration of it last session, and so that was sort of a reason that we didn't take action at that time, but we're going to continue to do that work. Chair Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Marquardt, I just had a quick question on the outreach for the child tax credit. I have a community in Hopkins that was noted by Department of Revenue a few years ago of having a large amount of folks that probably qualified that weren't applying. And I was wondering, who do we get a hold of in your office to see if we could do some outreach, some extra outreach in that area?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Representative Joaquin, thank you so much. So, I mean, myself, Ms. Bears, and we can get that to the proper folks. I just talked last week with Commissioner Halverson from Dakota County, and we're plugged in there. And so we're hearing more and more. And, I mean, it's going to be kind of the game right to the end, kind of like the Super Bowl. It's going to go right to the end. And because we just – and then we've got to get folks – because a lot of folks might not know where do I go and so forth, and that's where we've got to plug them in with the nearest Vita sites. Or I know some of our advocacy groups are willing to get involved and even do over virtual and get them lined up with whoever to file those taxes.
Thank you. Chair Joachim.
Thank you. Greatly appreciate it. In Hopkins, a lot of people don't realize 30% of our households make under $35,000 a year. So thank you. I will be contacting you.
Yes.
Yeah, and I would just urge anybody who kind of encounters one of these issues in their local community, definitely reach out to Ms. Bears. You know, they've been really helpful, even in, like, really granular ways. Like, I'm like, oh, can you help me get a little flyer to put on the counter at this mental health clinic that we know serves a lot of these communities, and they've just been really responsive. And so, yeah, just I think that I appreciate just the interest in, like, figuring out every possible way it is that we can get the word out. And so if you have ideas, I think, I don't want to speak for you guys, but it seems like your doors are very open to all of those kind of things that are coming from our communities. So thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And I also want to echo Representative Robbins' comments. In my experience, the department's well run. So I want to commend you on that. So thank you. I want to just bring something to your attention. This is the cannabis bill issue, because you're going to get tied into that with sales taxes. Last fall there was a registry that the state put out that any retailer that sells any kind of CBD or topical or whatever had to sign up on this registry. But according to the registry, you had to sign up anyway, even if they're topical and they're actually not taxable. I don't know. Okay, so now there's a database out there that you can't get off of, by the way, even if you stop selling topical CBD products. And it's all around the state. So it's going to get tied into the Department of Revenue. But many of those retailers do not sell taxable CBD products or have no way to get off that. Or maybe they have some that are taxable and some that aren't, because topicals aren't, and so on. So I just want you to be aware of this as you have to roll out your sales tax. You know.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for that. Yes.
It's a mess. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, no, yeah. Thank you.
New things to do.
Yeah.
Good?
Thank you.
Yep, great. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Also, thank you for all this work. I think it's going to be really beneficial to a lot of taxpayers across Minnesota, particularly the renter's credit, which I'm very grateful for. One question I did have, especially when it came to the rebate checks and all the work you guys did with the IRS to get the waiver, and you mentioned this, is how useful do you think then purpose statements are, particularly in the context of tax committee? Because
we'll put you on the list, David.
And I don't really mean it to be funny, but it's actually a real question. Like, we were seriously burned here, and, you know, a lot of people are going to have an additional federal tax liability, and we worked on this issue when you were in the legislature. And so I'm just wondering from you, like, knowing that in the Minnesota legislature it's not necessarily our norm, but in some cases it seems like it's really beneficial. So just be interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, Chair, Commissioner Marquardt.
So, I mean, of course, yeah, that's been a kind of a moment of discussion there. But on tax expenditures, we're supposed to have purpose statements on them. But this one, I don't think this would have been a tax expenditure. I don't think you would have put a purpose statement on this anyway. Maybe someone can correct me. I don't think this would have been a tax expenditure. So you might not have, there might not have been a requirement to do that anyway. And yeah, I mean, certainly as 2020 hindsight, you know, if we could go back, we'd put something in there. But I mean, typically we don't. unless it's a tax expenditure. And I mean, I guess you could, but I wouldn't suggest that you would put them on every bill. Tax expenditures, I think that's fine, good. You know, we've talked about that, but so I don't, like on this one, I don't think we normally would have put one on there anyway, but.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative? Good. Okay. We were all kind of looking at Sean, I think, the whole room. We're like, it might be kind of a judgment call as to whether it's a tax expenditure. I'm sorry. Patrick just was like, just go to David's. Don't call Sean up. But okay. We'll save that for another day. Representative Davids, any thoughts on purpose statements over there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. After the wise words of the commissioner, I pass.
Sounds good. All right. Well, that was the last name I had on the list. Does anybody else have anything for the good of the order? All right. Not seeing any. Our next hearing of the committee will be. What am I supposed to do? We just got started, baby. I'm sorry. Okay.
Madam Chair and members,
thank you so much.
Please get a hold of us if there's anything we can do. I'm very, very serious about that. Thank you very much.
I thought you were going to dismiss. Please, nobody leave. No. Thank you so much, Ms. Bears and Commissioner Marquardt. Always a pleasure to see you. Next up, we have a House fiscal overview of the tax bill. And so we're going to call up Ms. Templin, I think, and Ms. Heinrich.
Hi, Mark.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. Okay. Hi, Mark. I'll get it. Okay. Heinrich's some other guy around here. What? That wasn't mean, was it? I don't know. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. It's good to be back. I would also just like to reintroduce again my new colleague that is focusing on the property tax aids and credit side of the ledger, Ms. Katrina Highmark. She will be going over that section of the presentation today. You should have before you a hard copy of the presentation to follow along if it's easier. Our objective, you know, with this presentation is to give you a high-level overview of the tax provisions in Chapter 64. And in the interest of time, we will not be going over each line item or each fiscal change, but we will be just again focusing on the highlights of the bill. And I should also mention that you should each have a copy of this spreadsheet. And in the presentation, we refer to page and line numbers of specific appropriations if you would like to look it up. But if you would like to see the detail again, you can find it in this document. Moving on. So our areas of focus today are tax revenues and property tax aids and credits. I will be focusing on state tax revenues, specifically three major tax types: individual income tax, corporate tax, and sales and use taxes. And there are also a few other tax provisions that will be highlighted as well as fees that will be discussed. So that brings us to one more slide, thank you, to slide four. The next two slides are graphs that show the two biennia that Chapter 64 impacts. Using end of session estimates, the first graph that you see compares current law general fund tax revenue for the 24-25 biennium to estimated tax law changes enacted in Chapter 64 for the 24-25 biennium. And you can see that Chapter 64 is estimated to have a net general fund revenue reduction of about $2 million. In that biennium. And then moving to the next slide, this shows the same information but for the 26-27 biennium, which are the tails. And in this biennium, the Chapter 64 tax law changes are estimated to have a total general fund net revenue reduction of $1.2 billion in fiscal 26 and 27. So you can see that there, not all of the tax law changes were ongoing changes. There were some one-time changes in the Chapter 64 bill. So moving on, and we'll talk about those in the next slides. Just as a preface, on slides 8 through 15, we will cover the net changes in the tax revenue for income tax, sales tax, and corporate tax. And for each tax type, I've tried to group them in provisions that raise revenue and provisions that change existing tax expenditures, and also highlight any new tax expenditures for each tax type. Because this is a fiscal presentation, we will also show the timing of when the revenue changes impact the general fund by highlighting the effective date and a sunset date, if a sunset date exists. So moving on to individual income tax, Chapter 64 had the largest impact on individual income taxes and the largest general fund tax changes. For the fiscal 24 and 25 biennium, there's an estimated $2.5 billion in general fund net tax revenue reductions. And again, not all of the reductions were ongoing. In fiscal 26 and 27, there is an estimated $1.675 billion in general fund net revenue reductions. So a few provisions that raise revenue, you can see, are listed. The provisions that raise revenue you see listed here, some of the same provisions are also listed on slide 10 for corporate taxes, because they affect both income tax and corporate tax. So the provision that raises the largest, or is estimated to raise the largest amount of revenue, is the standard deduction, which we talked about. And this provision is estimated to raise $354.3 million in fiscal 24 and 25, and $385 million in 26 and 27. At the other end of the spectrum, another revenue raiser that is a little smaller in scale that is new is the net investment income tax, and that is estimated to raise $86.2 million in 24 and 25, and $176.5 million in 26 and 27. So moving on, thank you. So on slide 8, this slide shows the individual income tax tax expenditures that have been modified in Chapter 64, and you can see listed is the child tax credit, and the Commissioner Marcourt just discussed that provision and the work that the department has been doing since the conference committee ended. The working family credit, child tax credit, one thing that I would just like to also, one thing that he didn't cover that I'll just mention is that this new child tax credit has a estimated revenue reduction of $797.4 million in 24 and 25, and $819 million in fiscal 26 and 27, and this impacts tax year 23 and is an ongoing provision. Another major tax expenditure modified is the Social Security subtraction. That is effective in 23, and this is ongoing. It has an estimated revenue reduction of about $5 million in 24 and 25, and $576.8 million in 26 and 27. I guess I'll just highlight another one affecting another tax expenditure that was modified. The general fund for tax year 23 through tax year 30, the film production tax allocation was increased, and that tax that credit was extended. The fiscal impact is $18.6 million in 24 and 25, and $25.7 million in 26 and 27. I'll move on for the sake of time. I know we're running short on time. Slide 9. On slide 9, this slide shows, again, some more new tax expenditures that were created in Chapter 64, and also it shows some other individual income tax provisions. On this slide, I would just highlight the renter's income tax credit. Again, that is another provision that the commissioner discussed in today's presentation. That is the renter's income tax credit that converts the property tax refund to an income tax credit, and that income tax credit will be reflected on the M1 starting in tax year 2024. This has an estimated general fund revenue reduction of $378 million in fiscal 24 and 25, and $768.3 million in 26 and 27. I should mention that after offsetting savings from the repeal of the property tax credit, this has an estimated kind of net cost of $378.6 million in fiscal 25 and $275.5 million in the tails. My colleagues, Ms. Highmark and Mr. Williams, will also be discussing this change in the presentation. Finally, I should also mention the direct payment refund to taxpayers. Commissioner Marquardt also discussed that program and how the department is working on it. The Chapter 64 budgeted $1.1 billion in fiscal 23, one time only for those payments. And I believe the department has reported that $990 million has actually been spent as of December 2023. Okay, moving on to slide 10, corporate franchise taxes. In the fiscal 24 and 25 biennium, there is an estimated $595.4 million in general fund net tax revenue. This is an estimated increase in revenue with the Chapter 64 tax law changes. And for the fiscal 26 and 27 biennium, there is an estimated $498.6 million in general fund net tax revenue increases from the tax law changes. Let's see, on this list of the tax provisions that raise revenue for corporate taxes, you can see the guilty subtraction is listed, and that is estimated to raise about $439.7 million in fiscal 24 and 25. And then I should also note at the other end of the scale is the net operating loss tax changes in Chapter 64, which we've discussed earlier. That is estimated to have $39.4 million in 24 and 25, and $35.5 million in 26, 27, and in additional tax revenue. And then finally, in corporate taxes, there is an existing tax expenditure that was modified, and this is the historic rehabilitation tax credit. This is effective fiscal year 25, and for this provision, the sunset for that credit was extended through fiscal year 2033. This has an estimated cost of $3.8 million in 24 and 25, and $22.8 million in 26 and 27. Next slide, thank you. Now on slide 11, turning to sales taxes. In sales taxes, Chapter 64 is estimated to reduce revenue by $48.5 million in 24 and 25. And by $23.9 million for the biennium in 26 and 27. Again, a revenue reduction. we'll just go to the next slide. On slide 12, six tax expenditures, new and existing tax expenditures are listed along with their effective dates. I will just highlight at the bottom, there were about 20 temporary exemptions on construction materials for cities, counties, and airports that were enacted. Grouped together, these exemptions cost about $20 million, with most of the fiscal impact in the first biennium. And then finally, on slide 13, this is kind of, this slide just shows everything else. And this is the kind of the other tax types and other items in tax revenues. The net changes that are for 24 and 25, there's an estimated $39.5 million in tax and non-tax revenue reductions and $42 million in the tails in reductions as well. I should highlight the combined net tax receipts rate reduction that had an estimated cost of I believe it's about $30 million each biennia. And and then finally, there's one more slide, just another other provisions, fiscal provisions that were changed. There was also the repeal of a fee. Tax committee also, you know, dealt with fees, and there was a $50 payment plan agreement fee that was repealed, and that also had a small fiscal cost. And that is a really high-level overview of the tax, state tax provisions in Chapter 64. And my colleague, Ms. Highmark, will proceed with the property tax changes in the bill.
Thank you so much, Ms. Templin. Before we switch to property taxes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I was thinking of something. We were talking about the renter's credit, the what? So that used to be a form that renters filled out separately. But didn't get 1099, but they get a separate check. And now it's being put on the taxes, which I think is great. Except, aren't we going to run into the same issue? Now it's deductible. Now it's changing the gross income. It's essentially going to be taxed federally if there's a federal tax liability.
We're going to call up Mr. Williams on that one.
Thanks.
Excellent question. Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Anderson, so the renter's credit starting in tax year 2024 is going to be a refundable income tax credit, so it's not going to change any income definitions. You know, we don't know for sure how the IRS will rule on this, but there's a Commissioner Markwart mentioned the general welfare exclusion, which is just it generally refers to means-tested programs that are tested based on income, and typically the IRS has ruled that provisions like the working family credit or the child credit are also would be covered by the general welfare exclusions, so they would be excluded from gross income. So, you know, we obviously don't know for sure, especially in light of recent events, how the IRS will determine. But, you know, generally, I would say, given the income thresholds and the renter's credit, which are a lot lower than the rebate credit, my guess is that probably it would be covered by the general welfare exclusion.
Okay, thank
Representative
you.
Anderson?
Thank you.
Good.
Yeah.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We should probably put a purpose statement on that.
I didn't say it out loud, did I?
We'll never tell. all right. Any other questions before we move on to Ms. Highmark? All right. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Tempin. I'm going to be, as my colleague mentioned, talking again about a high-level overview of property tax aids and credits expenditure changes. I'm getting over a cold, so I apologize that I don't sound very good at the moment. Similar to what my colleague Ms. Templin did, I will be speaking to the larger items and changes in that were enacted in Chapter 64. I will also highlight the effective dates in this presentation. I'm going to talk about forecasted spending. The Fiscal year 24-25 forecast base was $4.4 billion, and we have a net increase in forecasted spending of $880 million for the enacted fiscal year 24-25 base of $5.3 billion. In the tails, we actually see that this levels off. This is in part because of this renter's property tax refund is shifting from being in my category in the spreadsheets of a credit, right, and is moving over into Ms. Templin's part of the spreadsheet as a revenue reduction. And so for my numbers, we have a net reduction in forecasted spending of $48.1 million from the original forecast base. And again, this is in the tails for fiscal year 26 and 27. I will be talking about property tax refunds, aids and credits, and then a few other changes in this presentation. I'll be talking about net changes, and I want to highlight again the spreadsheet that you were all given that my colleague Ms. Templin also referenced. When I'm talking about the net changes, that information is actually in the last three pages in an appendix, because those net changes are referring to selected credits, aids, and refunds, which are not coinciding with the numbers in the full spreadsheet, because I, again, am not looking at everything in the full spreadsheet. So if you have questions about where those numbers come from, they are highlighted within the sheet. For the general fund changes to property tax refunds, aids, credits, and other, we have an $880 million cost in fiscal year 24 and 25, which actually converts to a $48 million cost savings in fiscal year 26 and 27. In each of these categories, I'll be talking about one-time provisions, which is one-time spending, or ongoing modifications, which is spending that continues past one biennium. So in talking about property tax refunds, taking the renter's credit conversion out of the equation, we have a $233 million cost in fiscal year 24 and 25, and then that is reduced to $42 million cost in fiscal year 26 and 27. When we include the renter's credit conversion into the equation, because the renter's credit conversion does not impact fiscal year 24-25, we don't see a change, but we do see a change in the tails, again, resulting in a cost savings because we are no longer reimbursing renters with a property tax credit. It is being used as a revenue reduction, and so that is why on my part of the spreadsheet, once again, it's showing up as a cost savings. One-time provisions, not including the renter's credit conversion, has zero cost in the tails and $209 million cost fiscal year 24-25. The largest provisions in this category are the additional 20.6% refunds that Commissioner Marquardt talked about earlier today. The total cost of that one-time increase for both the homestead credit refund and the renter's property tax refund is $185.7 million, again, in fiscal year 24 and 25. For ongoing modifications, this does include our renter's credit conversion once again, so we do see a difference of cost in fiscal year 24 and then cost savings in fiscal years 26 and 27. There's a lot of ongoing modifications. I've selected, highlighted a few here. The largest in this category is the reduction of homeowner copays by 3%, which has a cost of $25.4 million in fiscal year 24 and 25. And the smallest in this page is the spouse's disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion application. For the renter's property tax credit refund, repealing that property tax credit results in a cost savings of almost $500 million, which also my colleague Ms. Templin explained that in terms of a revenue reduction, I believe the net cost is about $380 million. Something along those lines. That's what I wrote down. So, thank you. Selected aids and credits. We have a larger cost in fiscal year 24 of $640 million and almost $400 million cost in fiscal year 26 and 27. Some of these one-time provisions, probably the most notable is that $300 million in public safety aid that was given to several different local governments that was effective in pay 2023. And in addition, there are some other one-time provisions for the cities of Echo and Moreton, Spring Grove, and Northfield for different local aids. In terms of ongoing modifications, fiscal year 24-25, we have a total cost of $281 million. That increases to $460 million in the TAILS. The largest changes here are in appropriation increase for local government aid and county program aid, which was $800 million each for fiscal year 24 and 25. Additional ongoing modifications, I want to highlight the statewide local housing aid that was established and had a cost of $45 million for fiscal year 24 and 25 as well. Selected other changes I want to highlight are Representative Robbins, your question for Commissioner Marquardt, I'm also going to answer here in the presentation. Some of the other changes I'm highlighting, there's lots of other changes in the property tax side of the spreadsheet, but I'm just going to highlight three. The one that Representative Robbins mentioned was the Department of Revenue Administration of Refundable Credit. That was a one-time expenditure of $22 million for fiscal year 23 and also fiscal year 24. I believe it was $1 million in fiscal year 23 and $21 million in 24. And then we also have a Department of Revenue Administration of the 2023 Tax Act of $3 million, which is ongoing. So that leaves the Housing Development Fund for that final piece for the other changes, which is only in fiscal year 24 and 25. So with that, I want to finish the presentation. Thank you all for your attention. And both myself and Ms. Tumblin would be very happy to answer any questions you may have today or in the future or at any point. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Highmark. Great job. Are there any questions before we move on? All right, I'm not seeing any. So we have obviously our whole House research team here. They have a presentation for us. We're going to just push that to our next meeting and adjourn. And then I'm sure if there are questions that come up about the fiscal half next week, these guys would be more than happy to entertain them. Since we are going to be using these same materials, please just keep them in your folders so that Lauren doesn't have to kill a bunch more trees for us. Our next hearing will be Tuesday, February 20th. We're going to finish up with House Research, talk about child tax credit implementation a little bit. So that will be happening 1 p.m. right here, Tuesday, February 20th. And with that, we are adjourned.